To commemorate the 80th anniversary of D-Day, we're releasing three special episodes to tell the full story of the longest day. This third part is a brand new episode looking beyond the beaches.
From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to this special episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. D-Day 80, Part 3, Block D to Bocage. Bletchley Park made a vital contribution to the planning and preparation of D-Day, but the landings were only the beginning. There would be another 3 months of hard fighting in Normandy before the German forces finally cracked and France could be liberated. Ultra intelligence from Bletchley Park gave crucial support to Allied commanders throughout the battle, but knowledge rarely translated directly into action. Those generals and airmen faced with the mammoth task of orchestrating a modern all-arms battle had to balance numerous competing priorities, of which intelligence was rarely the most important. In this episode, research officer Dr. Thomas Cheetham has delved into the detail of five turning points to explore exactly how and how far Bletchley Park contributed to Allied victory in the Battle of Normandy. Many thanks to Joel Desborough for playing the part of our RAF SLU officer.
Back in the English Channel, great convoys of troops and reinforcements continued to move toward the beaches of Normandy. The beachhead already had expanded to 50 miles, and they put ashore the complete equipment of a highly mechanized army. Among those witnessing the beachhead operation was the Supreme Allied Commander, General Eisenhower. Here he meets with Admiral Ramsay, Chief of Naval Operations, and with Britain's great soldier, General Montgomery. The Supreme Commander is on hand to learn firsthand how the offensive is going. What he learned was good indeed. The meeting of these brilliant leaders symbolizes the unity of the United Nations forces they represent. The Allies have found firm resistance and are prepared for even stronger contests. Less than a week after the initial landings, we had taken 10,000 prisoners. There is much hard fighting ahead. But the Germans are now faced with a three-front war in the northern reaches of Russia, in the mountains of Italy, and here against this most tremendous military operation in history.
This is our third and final episode of this little mini-series to commemorate D-Day 80. The first episode looked at the build-up of 18 months of hard work that the Western Front Committee did to help create a full picture of the German order of battle before D-Day. Part two just looked at June the 6th itself and the invasion with the help of our veterans to tell the story of the longest day. Now to join me for part three is our research officer, Dr. Thomas Cheetham. Now, Tom, to a lot of people, D-Day basically boils down to just the day itself. And unfortunately, they don't sort of look in any detail as to what happens afterwards. We want to put that right, don't we?
Yes, and we want to do it properly as well. We've talked about the Battle of Normandy before, but I thought for this episode we could do something quite interesting by delving into the real detail of how intelligence is used during the battle to influence our decision-making.
Yes, because we previously, 5 years ago, did an episode called 90 Days, where you looked at the entirety of the Normandy campaign, because it lasts for 90 days. But as you say, we're going to take five vignettes, aren't we, in this episode?
Yeah, five key moments where Bletchley Park had an impact. But as we will see, that impact is maybe not as direct and not as clear-cut as some people have assumed, as maybe a simplified version would tell you. It's always a lot more complicated than you realize. And that becomes clear when you look into almost the minute-by-minute detail of when intelligence is arriving at the commands, who's reading it, and what decisions they're making.
Men of the French resistance movement come into their own. For years, they put up a noble fight behind enemy lines, looking toward the day of liberation. Now that great day has arrived. In a simple, though significant ceremony, the Cross of Lorraine is unfurled in the town square. Hearts swell with pride as civilians and military pledge anew their allegiance to those three great principles of the Republic: liberty, equality, fraternity.
Why is it so difficult to nail down exactly what Ultra did or didn't do, you know, in any battle?
Well, the first thing you've got to do is prove who knew what, when. And we can do that to a certain extent. We can read all the Ultra traffic going out from Humphrey at Bletchley Park, and we can see where it goes, and we can see who ought to have read it. What we can't prove is, did they pay any attention to it? Was that commander or were the staff at that headquarters distracted? Did they have their eye on something else at that time? You know, on occasion, of course, they're looking out for the intelligence they need, and on other occasions, they have bigger concerns. For us, we're obsessed with this stuff.
Yeah.
And we love to talk about intelligence, but for the commanders, you know, on the ground during the war, it's rarely at the top of their priorities.
They've got 100 things they're dealing with every day.
They've got a million things to think about. And then when they do make a decision based on a piece of intelligence, how do we know that? They rarely tell us. They rarely write it down. Because of field security, it's not obvious from the orders they're sending out or their own communications why they're coming to the decisions they're making.
Yeah, they don't send out a command saying, oh, due to this intelligence I've just received, I want you to do X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, sometimes they do, but in a camouflaged way.
Right,
more okay. Often they wouldn't bother. You just tell your subordinates what you want them to do. So then you think, well, why don't we ask them later? But the problem is most of these commanders died by the mid-70s when they were allowed to talk about Ultra. We'll see a couple of occasions where they do survive long enough to tell us what they thought, but then that's mediated by, obviously, the story they want to tell.
Yes.
You have this sort of battle of the memoirs that happens after the war, and it goes on for as long as these generals are alive, with their claims and counterclaims about who performed well and who performed badly.
Yes, it's all reputational wars, isn't
it? Absolutely. And, you know, this is a factor we have to take account of as well when we read how they describe how they use intelligence. So it's more often that we can say there was a potential impact of intelligence because it was in the commander's possession at the right time than prove that they actually acted on it.
We always have to qualify it, don't we?
We have to be very careful in the claims we make and not assume we know exactly what was going on. And, you know, it's a difficult process, and hopefully we'll draw out some of that complexity when we're going through this episode. We've got to be honest about what we know and don't know.
Okay, so why is it so important that we investigate these cases?
Well, we have to do the legwork because we know the impact is there. On D-Day itself, Bletchley Park has relatively little influence. It's important in the planning, and it's important in the battle that comes about after the initial invasion. Ralph Bennett, who is our go-to on Ultra, the guy who read all of the traffic and wrote it up in a couple of excellent books, tells us that to begin with, nothing of much importance came to hand. Gradually, however, the volume of traffic and the value of its content began to rise reassuringly. And within 2 or 3 days of the invasion, we were giving Western commands the same service we'd been accustomed to provide to headquarters in Africa and Italy for the past 3 years, supplying a continuous stream of high-grade information and an occasional item of absolutely priceless significance. And Ralph Bennett knows because he was in Humphrey during the war.
Yep.
As part of the team translating and reporting this traffic. So he's done the legwork, and he's
definitely
a really important source for us.
Now, we often say in the podcast that you always have to look at the big picture, at what Ultra could bring to the campaigns. But from what you're saying, you want to focus more on detail in this episode.
Yeah, I think the examples we're going to look at, they do highlight a middle ground exists, you know. So we often say that it's the big picture of the enemy that makes a difference. It gives them that big picture of what the enemy are doing and their situation that conditions all of their planning. And that's true. But what these particular cases also highlight is that sometimes really important intelligence comes from not the big picture, but a very small handful of messages, or even just one message. And that's interesting because it shows you how targeted the signals intelligence operations are at Bletchley Park. That they're able to take, you know, a couple of thousand messages a day from German Enigma, not counting all those other sources of SIGINT, and pick out just a couple of decrypts, potentially, that contain the information you need, and prioritising those. It emphasises how efficient and professional the system is by this point in the war that they're able to do that.
The curé of this little Normandy church, 2 or 3 miles from Caen, wants me to say how sorry he is about these bells. His village has only just been liberated, and it's taken until yesterday to clean up the many German snipers left in hiding. When I asked the curé if we might record the bells of his church ringing in celebration of the village's freedom, he asked me to wait for a week, and this is why. They used to have a very lovely little carillon in this church. Only 3 bells, but they were very proud of it, and many of the villagers were expert bell ringers. But when the Allies freed the village, 3 German snipers hid in the square tower of the church, and for 2 nights they were very troublesome. At last they gave themselves up, but it was found that they had smashed the big bell of the carillon. Monsieur le Curé promised that if I would only wait a week, he would have the big bell repaired, and you could hear the full carillon. But he added that in any case, they were going to ring the remaining 2 bells at once this morning to celebrate our coming. And I thought that you would rather hear the bells now, even though the big one has been smashed by the Germans, to let you know that the people of Normandy are celebrating their liberation. The church bells are ringing, and the villagers are going to mass to give thanks for their freedom.
Well, let's get stuck in. What's the first example you have for us, Tom?
My first example is the bombing of the headquarters of Panzergruppe West on the 10th of June. This is a key German headquarters. Now, those who are familiar with the story of Battle of Normandy will know that a big controversy in the German high command was about the use of armour. And Rommel's opinion, being in charge of Army Group B in Western France, was that the armour had to be as close to the beach as possible and throw the Allies back into the sea with an immediate counterattack. Von Rundstedt at OB West, Commander-in-Chief West, is of the opinion that you need to keep the armour away from the beaches and further inland to form a strong central counterattacking force, which you can then unleash at the opportune moment against the Allied forces when they're ashore.
His argument being that they didn't know it was going to be Normandy. They didn't know where the landings were going to be at all, did they?
Absolutely. So you don't want to spread your armour out in penny packets and have it destroyed. And you don't want to expose it to naval gunfire as well on the beaches. It's a lesson Rundstedt had taken from battles in Italy. So what happens with the armour is that the Germans eventually reach an awkward compromise where some of the divisions are under Rommel's command and relatively close to the shore. Some of them are under Hitler's personal command, his personal approval to release them for action, and they're organised in this command called Panzergruppe West. And this is going to be one of the key formations which the Allies are going to have to deal with in the days after D-Day. They don't know a lot about those debates going on in the German command. They don't care, to be honest. What they knew is that Panzergruppe West exists, that it controls armoured divisions, and it's an important headquarters. So when it shows up in the signals intelligence, it's a target that they want to do something about.
So is there a clear date where they show up in the signals for the first time?
Yeah, so it's always the case that the Germans only use their radios when they absolutely have to. They're getting quite savvy about signal security by this point in the war and about the benefits of radio silence. And that's not because they think the Allies are reading Enigma. It's because they know about traffic analysis and they know the Allies have tactical Y units as well, picking this traffic up. And even if they can't break it, they can deduce a certain amount from it. So the first signal which Bletchley-Park actually reads, which mentions Panzergruppe West, shows up only on the 8th of June. And it's in relation to a formation called 17th SS, which we're going to learn about in the next section. It doesn't tell them much, only the fact that this formation is active. And the next they hear about it really is on the 9th of June, Hupfried decrypts a message stating that the battle HQ of Panzergruppe West is in a new location. And about 9 hours later, they're able to fill out the details and report where that location is.
KV-7225, 0439 hours, 10th of June 1944. Battle headquarters of Panzergruppe West on the evening of the 9th at Le Caen, T9-152.
One specific message comes in on the 10th of June. It enables the RAF to attack that HQ on the evening of the same day. Now, an interesting point here, which I think might be quite meaningful, is that the first of these decrypts, the fact it moved its headquarters, it sent
to only some of the air forces. It's sent to the tactical air forces out in Normandy, supporting the troops on the ground. The second decrypt, given the location, it's sent to all the Allied air forces, including the strategic ones. And that might indicate that Hutfree had received a phone call saying, when we spot this headquarters, we're going to try and bomb it. And they make sure that anyone who might be involved in that operation gets the decrypt as quickly as possible so they can act on it.
So they would have been getting requests like that fed back to them regularly?
We don't know a lot of the details because the records aren't there because it's telephone conversations, but we know that Hutfree is in phone contact with various customers who are giving it indications of the sort of intelligence they need at a particular point in time.
What does this decrypt actually lead to?
So signals intelligence doesn't do all the work. It doesn't seem like on this occasion it gives you all the information you need. It's not a silver bullet that as soon as you hear the name of a place in a decrypt, you can bomb it. And it's worth noting that what goes on here, it isn't direction finding. Some of the books suggest that the Allies locate this signal as emanating from the headquarters and they're able to use direction finding to pin it down. And that doesn't seem to be the case. Direction finding is just simply not accurate enough to do that, to pin down and transmit it to a particular village in a particular valley in Normandy. The decrypt does state that the headquarters is in the village of Laquenne, but you've still got to accurately pinpoint it. Now, the Allies would be able to look at their maps and see there's a chateau in the village and it's a likely location of the headquarters, but you can't put on a bombing raid on the assumption of where the Germans are. You need to know. So that's probably done using a reconnaissance aircraft, sending a reconnaissance aircraft over. Apparently, the Germans do see one in the area, and that's got a secondary benefit, which is that it acts as a cover for the signals intelligence and gives the enemy a reason why you know where their headquarters are. And then you've got to put the raid on. You've got to actually get to the target and hit it. And that's, of course, an incredibly difficult thing to do at the best of times. You know, these air operations that they launched during the war, there's an awful lot of planning and preparation and skill and expertise and luck that goes into getting a force together, flying to a particular target, especially a target smaller than a single chateau, and hitting it. And we can see that that's the case because on actually the same day as they bomb Laquenne, there are two other raids that go on another headquarters, that of 1st SS Panzer Corps in Normandy, which had also been pinpointed by Ultra. And these raids don't hit anything. So there may be a difference in that Panzergruppe West failed to camouflage its vehicles or something along those lines that made it easier to spot where they were based. But you can't take it for granted that just because you've spotted a target, you can hit it effectively. But this is exactly what they end up doing. The raid goes in on the evening of the 10th of June. There are over 100 aircraft involved. You have two waves of Typhoons. So these are sort of ground attack fighter aircraft, fighter bombers. A total of 34 of those, which go in two waves armed with rockets. And they aim for the vehicles they can see and try and hit as much as possible. And in between the two waves of Typhoons, you have a sort of carpet bombing attack by over 60 B-26 Mitchells carrying their maximum bomb load, and they just plaster this village. The staff of the HQ are mostly out in the grounds of the chateau watching the raid, and they don't realise that they're the target of these bombers until the Typhoons start firing rockets at them. So they're as vulnerable as they could possibly be. And the commander, a commander called Georg von Schweppenberg, he's just arrived at the headquarters as the raid begins. He's wounded. Most of the staff of the HQ are killed pretty much immediately, including the chief of staff. And many of their vehicles are destroyed and also most of their radio equipment. So what this does is, you know, even the remnants of the HQ, they're in no fit state to do anything useful. You take that HQ unit out of the battle. It takes a couple of weeks before it's back reconstituted in a fit state to play a part in the battle. And as a, you know, a surgical strike on a really key bit of sort of command and communications infrastructure, it's an excellent example.
It sort of ranks with what we'd expect nowadays, isn't it? As a really surgical strike on something.
Yeah, there's this assumption, I suppose, during the war that when you carry out bombing, it's pretty indiscriminate. And usually it is, but occasionally they're able to be much more targeted when they have the right intelligence to go on.
I mean, can we say what benefit this leads to?
Yeah, so same time as it being a really impressive application of intelligence, it's also a good reminder why we can't assume there's an impact. Because the natural assumption we make is that, well, this is the main German armoured headquarters and we know that the Germans are planning a counterattack. Therefore, when they don't launch a counterattack, it must be because they've lost their headquarters. But it may not actually have been that decisive in practice, because it seems that if you look at the details of the German thinking, they had already decided against launching a counterattack for various logistical reasons and the fact they need the tanks to shore up the front line before the headquarters is actually attacked. So it may have been that the armoured divisions would have been committed to the front piecemeal anyway. There would have been a major armoured counterattack. But it definitely doesn't hurt to remove one of the major German headquarters from the picture for 2 or 3 weeks before it becomes operational again.
The Allies, not embarrassed by a shortage of manpower, continue to pin their faith in the accurate destruction of military objectives rather than indiscriminate attacks by flying bombs. Here's one of our newest weapons, the rocket-firing Typhoon, known to the RAF as their flying artillery. Every day, these Typhoons are over enemy territory, shooting up enemy headquarters, radio location stations, gun positions, observation posts, and other objectives. One plane carries 8 projectiles, 4 under each wing. They can be fired separately or in one devastating salvo. Several types of plane are equipped with rockets, and great results have already been scored. The Russians fitted their Stormoviks with similar weapons to destroy German armor. Well, now we have them too, and very successful they are.
Now, Tom, what's our second example, and why have you picked it?
Our second example is the Battle of Carentan on the 13th of June, which listeners may be familiar with from Band of Brothers, one of my favourites. And this is one of the first cases during the campaign where Ultra makes a direct impact to events on land. And it seems at first glance very clear-cut what the impact is, but as we will see, it is in fact a good example of how even excellent intelligence translates quite indirectly into actual orders given on the ground.
Now, for people who haven't watched Band of Brothers, what's the background to this?
So this is a really key objective during the early part of the landings, the town of Carentan. If you picture a map of Normandy, you have the Cotentin Peninsula, the coast turns north at the west end of the beachhead, and that's where you have Utah Beach at the bottom end of the peninsula, and Omaha Beach, the next beach along to the east, is kind of at the bottom of the L shape where the coast makes that turn.
It's kind of like a thumb sticking up, isn't it?
Absolutely.
With Cherbourg at the north of it.
Yeah. And in between, there is the estuary of a couple of rivers and the town of Carentan. So you have this marshy, low-lying land with a couple of roads crossing it, and they all run through the town. So the town is absolutely crucial. If you're going to link up the entire beachhead, you have to capture Carentan. For the Germans, it's a vital place to hold, and any objectives that arrive at the front, they're going to throw them in as quickly as possible to try and hold the town and create this wedge between the two American beaches, which they can hopefully exploit later.
And was this an early objective to capture it?
Yeah, it's one of the objectives of the 101st Airborne Division, which has landed on the night of 5th and 6th of June. In the days after D-Day, after they sort of secure their landing zone and form up and get organised, they head straight to Carentan, and they have a very tough fight actually down these causeways through this marshy ground. Very little room to manoeuvre. There's a point where a big chunk of one of the regiments is attacking down one road, and it's blocked by what they call a Belgian gate. So it's a big metal structure designed to block the road and be hard to move. They can just move this Belgian gate just far enough for one man at a time to slip through. So you've got almost the spearhead of the Allied invasion is a gap of a couple of feet running down this road. And after this very tough fight over several days to get down to the town, the 101st encircle it and then capture it on the 12th of June.
Obviously, the Germans realised the importance of the town, so I guess they're going to send reinforcements.
Absolutely. And those reinforcements specifically are the 17th SS Panzergrenadier Division, which has been down in the Loire Valley on D-Day, started moving north, and it arrives at the front just after the Americans capture the town.
Okay.
But they're just a bit too late to do what they needed to do. But they plan a counterattack, and that goes in, and it's a sticky moment for the US Airborne, because this division is armed with a certain amount of armour, and they've got limited anti-tank capability. But luckily, General Bradley, in charge of the American forces in Normandy, has managed to get some tanks off Omaha Beach and rush them to the front line in time to see off this German counterattack. And the town is safe, and they secure this link up between the two beaches. One of the reasons he's been able to do this is because Ultra has been giving very good information on the march of 17th SS northwards, and also gave details of that counterattack before it went in. So Bradley was forewarned through Ultra. So it seems like a very cut and dried case of Ultra having this impact. Bradley is one of the few generals who actually writes about his decisions after the Ultra secret was revealed by Frederick Winterbottom in 1974. So he publishes a book in 1983 called A General's Story, where he talks about how he used Ultra and tells us the Battle of Carentan was one of the rare times in the war when I unreservedly believed Ultra and reacted to it tactically, when he receives forewarning of the German counterattack.
Right, okay. Now, how would you describe Bradley's thoughts of or use of Ultra intelligence?
He does use Ultra. He's not an Ultra skeptic.
Right.
He's not one of these generals who says it's too good to be true and tries to almost avoid using it, as certain generals do. But he's not an enthusiast either, I wouldn't say. He's quite aware that it can be misinterpreted, that he's not going to be getting the full picture. There is going to be a way that he wants to fight a particular battle, which is not necessarily what the intelligence is telling him to do. And he's okay with that. When he tells us unequivocally that he used Ultra, that's unusual. And it seems like...
puts more weight on it.
Yeah, and it seems like in this case it should be pretty cut and dried.
Okay, what's the actual intelligence that he receives?
So it's good information about the movement of the Division North, 17th SS. And then there are two messages about a counterattack. One of them comes in at 11:01 on the 12th of June. And then luckily for Bradley, the counterattack is actually postponed for a few reasons. Firstly, because the division arrives later than planned because of Allied air attack. And also because it's had to deal with a group of American paratroopers holding out in a village called Grain. They've been dropped far away from their intended drop zone, but they are in just the right position to form a sort of roadblock that stops 17th SS getting in position for a vital couple of days. So they are thinking about this counterattack and talking about it in their messages, but by the time they actually get into position, it's later than they expected and they have to postpone it. So they send another message. This comes in at 21:59 on the 12th of June, and it's in Bradley's hands, therefore, the morning before the attack takes place.
KV7738, 21:59 hours, 12th of June 1944. Information, 15:30 hours on 12th. Reference, undertaking against location NV2B. Division to assemble area T3783 at 0320 hours and advance to attack along railway and road south of it against NV2B and then take the town. Division then intends to follow up to north and formation of bridgehead to line T4287 to T3789. Request for air attack with HE and incendiaries at 0230 hours on NV2B. From 0320 hours, attacks as continuous as far as possible in front of the attacking spearheads.
So what Bradley tells us is when this message comes in, he ordered General G. Gero of US 5th Corps to send part of the 2nd Armoured Division, which is just landed on Omaha Beach, to help the 101st Airborne at Carentan. And apparently he phrases this by saying, sorry to have to bother you, but consider this highly important. Very polite.
Very.
Not the sort of overbearing general, because the direct
order.
Not
the sort of message you'd expect Patton to send, maybe.
Indeed. But then we look at the course of events, and what's quite interesting is that it's clear there are a few confounding factors here as well. So on the 11th of June, based on interviews with POWs, 1st Army's intelligence, so Bradley's intelligence officers, had actually placed the 17th SS southeast of Carentan rather than southwest. So it seems from that they've quite misjudged its line of approach. And they seem to have also decided that the division had tanks, whereas it doesn't have tanks. It only has what the Germans call assault guns. So turretless sort of self-propelled guns. They're a threat, but it's not a full armoured division.
No.
And that mistaken intelligence seems to have had a lasting influence on what Bradley thought was going on over the next couple of days. On the night of the 12th, so after the key messages come in about the German plan to attack, there is a report that comes through from Norman Cota. Now, Norman Cota is the second in command of the 29th Infantry Division, which landed on Omaha Beach. And at that point, they are southeast of Carentan. Norman Cota is famous for his actions on the beach on D-Day. And he's portrayed by Robert Mitchum in The Longest Day.
Oh, right,
familiar,
yes.
Familiar with that film. He's the one who finds the Rangers on the beach and says, if you're Rangers, then get up and lead the way.
Yes.
So a personally brave man. he reports to 1st Army HQ, apparently, that he observed 150 German soldiers re-entering the town of Carentan. Somehow this is miscommunicated somewhere along the line as 150 German tanks.
What? Tanks instead of men?
Yes, they're expecting to see tanks coming from the southeast. So even though that's completely contradictory to the really good SIGINT, they almost send 2nd Armoured Division to fight these imaginary tanks instead of helping the 101st against the real counterattack. So there's obviously a lot of confusion going on about the true situation. And even more strangely is the fact that the paratroopers outside Carentan were ordered to make their own attack on the morning of the 13th.
Against armour?
Yeah, they know that a new German division is moving into place with a certain amount of armour, and they still prepare their own attack for that morning. Bradley doesn't actually make mention of that, which is possibly significant. And it's only because there is so much confusion in the American lines, it means their own attack is delayed, that they're still in their trenches when the Germans attack. And then they're on the defensive, which is where they really want to be.
Yeah.
So what exactly goes on there is unclear. Presumably the commander of the division, who wasn't in the picture about Ultra and wasn't being given good information from army headquarters. So he's apparently unaware of the German intentions. But there's obviously problems with command and control and just general confusion in the battle at this point. And the third slightly awkward fact is that even though warning had been received the previous night, the armour only arrives at Carentan, at the town itself, at about 10:30 in the morning on the 13th of June. And only in the afternoon do they advance out and actually defeat the German counterattack. And by that point, the paratroopers are under a lot of pressure. So you have to wonder if their response could have been prompter. And again, whether it had been communicated down the chain properly that the Germans are going to launch the counterattack, that the armour was there for a good reason.
Well, also, I imagine if the armour is expecting to face 150 German tanks, they've probably been somewhat cautious in their advancing at that
Perhaps
point.
Perhaps that's it.
I don't understand how they confused 150 men for tanks.
It's just one of those things that happens when you're fighting. And, you know, it's inevitable. And this is the point to make here. Even when you've got this example of absolutely priceless signals intelligence, they benefit from it, but not in a direct way, not as conclusively as you might expect. We might say in hindsight, it tells Bradley exactly what he needs to do. But evidently on the ground, on the day, there's so much confusion and contradictory intelligence and difficulty with command and control that you can't turn intelligence into action.
It seems strange that Bradley uses this as an example of when he did use Ultra then. Or are we looking at it in hindsight?
I think Bradley is looking at it in hindsight.
As well, probably. Right, okay.
And I'm no expert on his writing or him as a general particularly, but you can imagine that because he knows how it turned out, they do defeat the German counterattack. It's a significant victory for the Americans at the end of the day. And it's not one of these cases where there is a lot of disagreement about what ought to have been done. So it's one where he can safely say that Ultra had that impact.
Jerry's reaction to our breakthrough was to counterattack. Fighting, street by street, house to house, hand to hand. We were in it up to our necks, slugging it out with the Germans at Carentan. But we smashed it. And how?
Now, one of the, as we know now, unachievable goals of D-Day was to capture the city of Caen on day one of D-Day. And being able to advance 8 miles from the beaches to the largest city in the area was a little bit unachievable. So Caen plays a large part in quite a lot of the following weeks in the Battle of Normandy, doesn't it? And what we're going to look at now is Operation Epsom. Again, focusing on Caen.
Yeah, Caen is the big sort of bulwark on the eastern end of the invasion zone. Caen itself, obviously a significant built-up area. It's a tough target when it's been fully garrisoned by the enemy. And it's surrounded by rivers and hills that are tough to take as well. So it's ideal defensive terrain in many ways. But if you get past the city, there's a sort of plain that opens up leading southeastwards from there. This is the ground the British wanted to be on the days after D-Day, where they can use their armour to kind of thrust in the direction, eventually, of Paris. And it's still the objective when they don't capture Caen on the first day, to get into that more open terrain where the Allies can use their advantages in terms of especially numbers of tanks, but also just general firepower, air power in that more open terrain. So, you know, as the initial sort of assault loses its momentum, as things bog down a bit, as German reinforcements arrive and the front stabilises, the objective on the British side is to, as soon as possible, take Caen.
And that's when we start getting these one operation after another around that area, isn't it? Of which Epsom's one of the first, isn't it?
Yeah, Epsom is sort of an attempt to keep the momentum going and keep things fluid. And it's meant to be a sort of sweeping flanking move around one side of the city. But it's also the first sort of major set-piece offensive that the British launch in Normandy. So you have a detailed operational line, you have sort of phase lines which you expect your infantry to reach at a particular time, you have a fire plan and very large concentration of artillery to carry your troops through the enemy positions. And they're hoping that this will dislodge the Germans around Caen, and with a secondary objective as well.
The secondary objective being?
Being to draw in German reinforcements. Because we are seeing a shift at this stage in the battle, slightly away from the British side of the front being the main axis of advance, and more being a place to pin down German armour. The Germans are most worried about the British getting into the open terrain south of Caen, so they put most of their armour around the city to defend it. And if you can't take the city, well, the next best thing is to draw that armour in and make sure it can't be used for a major counterattack anywhere else, especially against the Americans further west.
Because at this point, the majority of the German army is attacking the British in Commonwealth sector, isn't it?
Yeah, something like three quarters of the German armour is always focused on the British.
Now, what's the ultra picture in Operation Epsom then? Is it clear or not so clear?
Again, in many of the books it's given as a pretty clear example, and it revolves around a particular German formation. And in this case, it's 2nd SS Panzer Corps. So there's two panzer divisions that have come from the Eastern Front, and they're well-trained, experienced, well-equipped. And the interpretation is that Epsom is launched in part to ensure that when those reinforcements arrive, they're thrown into this battle rather than being used for any bigger purpose on the German side. Bennett talks about how knowledge of the movements of 2nd SS Panzer Corps come from what he calls late decodes in an obstinately difficult army key. Now, what a really interesting aspect of Ralph Bennett's writing is that even though he was in Hut 3, and some of the decrypts that Humphrey's being provided with are from Lorenz ciphers rather than Enigma, he doesn't seem to have known anything about Lorenz.
Right. And when he writes his book in the late 70s, most of the Lorenz story hadn't even been started to be told, had it?
It wasn't that well understood. I think it was out there in parts, but not really full knowledge. But even when he's writing in the 90s, when there's much more information available, Bennett still sort of seems to have this blind spot around Lorenz. So whenever he says there was an army key that was difficult to crack and it took a few weeks, he's normally referring to Lorenz traffic, because normally Enigma traffic just doesn't take that long to break. Or if it does, it's so far out of date you don't bother breaking it. Whereas Lorenz material, quite routinely, it's taking at least a week to break each of these messages. That's because you have a very complicated process of wheel breaking on the machine itself and then having to set messages individually on the positions of the Lorenz wheels. So you break it message by message and it takes a very long time. But because these are high level messages and tend to be much longer, you get very good intelligence. So it's worth taking the time to do that. And we see that all the messages that Bennett cites around Operation Epsom seem to be Lorenz decrypts from the background. For example, there are clues there, like each ultra signal that goes out to commands, it has its own unique serial number. And it also has a reference number which denotes the source of that information, as in the original decrypt. And some of these signals going out have the same reference number several days apart. So that's the same Lorenz message being broken bit by bit.
Oh, right. Okay.
And they're revealing a bit more, and then they can send out another ultra signal to the commands.
I'd never thought of it like that, that because they're so big, it might take them days and days. You just think of a message is broken, it's broken.
Yeah. It's because there are machine elements of this work and hand elements of this work. And the hand elements, they go in fits and starts, of course. So sometimes you'll get half a message out, and you'll send it through to Humphrey because it's important enough, and they'll just have to wait for the rest later. These are basically von Rundstedt reporting back to the German high command the rail and road movements of all his reinforcements. So the state of knowledge from these sorts of decrypts when Epsom is launched is that they know 2nd SS Panzer Corps is in France. They know it's detrained in Nancy, in eastern France. But after that point, they don't know where it is. That information was current from the 18th of June. It's sent out on the 24th. Epsom is launched on the 26th. So immediately we have to wonder whether they're planning the offensive to pin down this particular unit, because they didn't even know during the early stage of the planning whether it had arrived in France. And as I say, when the battle is ongoing, they don't know where in France it is. Harry Hinsley, in the official history of intelligence, he states that when Operation Epsom was launched, the only major uncertainty about the German order of battle concerned the precise whereabouts of 1st SS Panzer Division and 2nd SS Panzer Corps. So those are two formations which will be drawn into Operation Epsom, and the British simply don't know where they are. And they won't know where they've been until after the battle's finished, because all of those decrets are arriving a week late. So you get a really good picture of what you've just done, what you've just achieved, but you can't plan in advance. You can't time your offensive to draw in a particular formation because you know when it's going to arrive. So that undermines, or at least it shows there must have been something more complex going on. And what it comes down to is basically the British commanders are taking a leap and they're saying there must be reinforcements arriving. We don't know quite what or where or when, but we know those reinforcements are on the way. So we're going to launch an offensive on that assumption, and we'll fill in the details later. Now, it's possible, of course, that they know about the movements of 2nd SS Panzer Corps from other sources. I don't have the full picture. And maybe there's air reconnaissance or tactical Y, or maybe they get something from the resistance that gives them a better picture. But from the ultra information, which is kind of the basis of the standard story about intelligence and Epsom, I'm unable to, you know, pin down the messages that tell them where that formation is. It all seems to arrive too late.
To Canadian units in France falls the honor of conducting the attack against Coppiquet. The little Norman town is considered to be one of the strongest points on the Caen perimeter. It is one of the keys to Caen itself. Careful planning is necessary to ensure perfect liaison with the British unit on the right flank. Their job is to invest ground south of Coppiquet. From well-prepared positions, German guns and mortars hit the Canadians with everything they've got. Their object is to smash our lines of communication before we can build up reserves for the attack. Despite their savage bombardment, troops, transport, and tanks move steadily forward to the starting point. At 5 o'clock on a misty morning, 0 hour approaches. A typical Montgomery mass of artillery is concentrated on the front. The order comes down from the operations room to open fire. Our guns open up with a devastating barrage, plowing a path of exploding shells over the town and airfield. Behind the barrage, our infantry and armor move. Smoke screens over the battlefield drift along the front, mixing with the haze from exploding shells. In the murk, visibility at times is zero. Augmenting the guns, rocket-firing typhoons dive like black meteors right on German positions. They blast with explosives at point-blank range. Heavy machine guns from wooded emplacements spurt out lines of tracers. Mortars throw in bombs at a rapid rate, softening up enemy positions. The combined weight of Canadian striking power goes all out, leaving the enemy dazed by its frightful violence. Advancing over a mile and a half of open ground, infantry, supported by armor, move into the town.
What actually happens in the battle then?
So the attack goes in, makes reasonably good progress, but of course it gets bogged down sooner or later. There are these sort of Norman villages and farmsteads, stone buildings that always are a tough nut to crack.
Yep.
And very tenacious German defence, as is typical. So the British don't advance as fast as they want, and they don't really get the sweeping movement around the city they want. What ends up happening is that a sort of salient is created in the German line, and it's created by the 15th Scottish Division, which is attacking, so it's known as the Scottish Corridor. And they get just over one of the rivers, the River Oden, and create a couple of bridgeheads on the other side of the river. And on the other side is high ground, and they just can't quite get on top of that high ground. So that's controlled by the Germans, and they have excellent observation over the British positions. And after a few days of this, it becomes obvious that they're not going to make that much more progress. And the danger is, of course, those reinforcements arriving and catching the British off guard and sort of imbalanced. And the assumption has to be that a counterattack is coming. And sure enough, Ultra gives advance warning of that. And that is when 2nd SS Panzer Corps arrives at the front. There's a message that comes through on the 29th of June. And a couple more in the days afterwards about these counterattacks.
XL70, 1325 hours, 29th of June 1944. Flevo, 9th SS Panzer Division at 0500 hours on 29th. Reported division moving up to the attack that morning. Battle HQ approximately T819492 at 0630 hours. Division counterattacking against breakthrough west of Caen. Front line is road running Gabrus to Granville to Tessel to Bretteville. At 0900 hours, attack postponed.
So as we said, the British don't get that ability to track the movements of this formation across northern France. They just see it when it arrives at the front and when it's about to attack, and their saving grace, as so often, is the Flevo traffic. Flevos are the Fliegerverbindungsoffiziere who coordinate between the German Army and Air Force. And because it's Air Force traffic, you can read it quite easily. They read this Flevo message. And another reason they have to rely on that traffic is because this counterattack actually is not coming down from the German high command. At this point in the battle, Rommel and von Rundstedt are both away at a conference with Hitler. So they can't give any orders. And the orders actually come from Friedrich Dolman, who's in charge of German 7th Army, the main army on the Normandy front. And he's sent into such a state of panic by the progress the British offensive has made that he orders this counterattack just before he commits suicide.
Oh.
So again, you know, Ultra can't tell you about a planning period for a counterattack that doesn't have an extended planning period. You know, if it's a spur of the moment decision by a German officer who's at his wit's end. So this warning that they do get from Ultra about this German counterattack that the reinforcements are about to launch comes only with about half an hour's notice before the attack actually arrives. So there's not really enough warning to act on. And actually, in the event, it might actually have been counterproductive, this intelligence.
And why is that?
Well, the message tells us that the Germans are planning this attack, but at 0900 hours, it had been postponed to 2 o'clock that afternoon. But we know that in hindsight, but they didn't know that then, when the attack would actually go in.
So they don't know when it's been postponed till.
Exactly.
Right.
Now, at this point in the battle, the British Army commander, Miles Dempsey, orders his main armoured division, which is on the other side of the Oder River, back north again to meet a German counterattack. And this is after the counterattack has come in and actually been defeated. But Dempsey doesn't seem to realise this. He doesn't seem to read the situation for what it actually is. And it's by conjecture, but it's possible he misinterpreted the reference to this postponement in the Ultra message as meaning the attack would not go in at 1400 on the 29th of June, but would actually go in on the 30th of June, the day after. Or at least, he couldn't dismiss the possibility of there being an even bigger counterattack the next day.
Ah, right, okay.
So he had to bring his armour back and be ready to meet it. And that was primarily the reason why they had to shut down the offensive.
Oh, right. So you're basically saying he doesn't know that this is the main attack.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Because the Ultra, even though it is a warning, it's open to interpretation. Mm,
as all intelligence is.
Indeed. So there's a possibility that if this Ultra hadn't come in, counterattack would have failed because warning clearly wasn't that necessary. Maybe Dempsey leaves his armoured division south of the river. Maybe they capture some more ground before the offensive gets shut down on the 29th, 30th of June. So there's always a chance of this intelligence coming in and being misread or being too open to interpretation, open to fair interpretation, and actually, in hindsight, causing problems, causing maybe a suboptimal decision to be taken.
Yes, because we always want to think that because a message has been broken and passed on to the commander, that one, it has all the information in it that they need, and two, that they'll make the correct decision. But we're basing all of that on hindsight, aren't we?
We are. It's very easy for us to do that. And we always have to remember that Humphrey always have to report what the Germans say. Even if it's not true, they have to report what the Germans are saying to each other. Even if they know it's out of date. Sometimes they can add a comment saying, we know this is out of date, see other intelligence report. But often they can't do that, and they have to work on the basis that not everything they're reading is absolutely true. Mm. And they have to hope that the commander out in the field, or at least his intelligence officers, approach the material in the same way. And I think they do understand that, but it's always open to interpretation. It's always quite tricky.
It's always nuanced, isn't it?
Yeah.
Again on the morning of July 25th, the planes came. One observer called the seemingly endless waves of planes the most imposing aerial parade I've seen since the beginning of this long war. In all, they dropped more than 4,000 tons of destruction. But the tactical effect was not immediately clear. Did the bomber attack destroy the efficiency of the German troops? No one could tell. For better or for worse, Cobra was launched. The troops moved out at once. Their immediate objectives were the towns of Marigny and Saint-Gilles. Capture of those towns by the infantry would give the Americans control of the roads leading south, and Collins would then be able to catapult his mobile armored forces forward. The gamble paid off. In mid-afternoon of the 26th, one armored column, having cracked the enemy's defenses around the town, rode through Saint-Gilles. There was no longer any doubt. The German line had definitely been penetrated. The 7th Corps had achieved its breakthrough. The Americans pressed their attack through rapidly crumbling German defenses. By the end of the month, United States forces stood at the base of the peninsula, at the gates of the province of Brittany. And a nightmarish phase of the battle, the war of stalemate, was over.
For our fourth example, we're going to move on a little further in the campaign to two operations, Operation Goodwood and Operation Cobra. Now, can you give us a bit of background to where we are in the overall Normandy campaign at this point?
So after Epsom, it wraps up at the end of June, and during Epsom, actually, at the same time, the Americans are securing the port of Cherbourg on the Cotentin Peninsula, and so both ends of the beachhead stabilise at this point. The British are trying to capture Caen, not making that much progress. The Americans are trying to work their way through the Bocage around the town of Saint-Lô in the west and improve their positions. But there's not a lot of movement on either side right through from the start of July until towards the end of the month, things start to move again.
Now, just explain quickly what the Bocage is.
The Bocage is this terrain you find in Normandy, especially in the American sector, which is characterised by very dense farmland with small fields surrounded by these high hedgerows, which are 2 or 3 metres tall, at least. They're basically built up over hundreds of years, and they're like walls. It's perfect defensive terrain. The Germans can emplace themselves in these hedgerows and fire out, and they make perfect cover. And for an attacker, it's an absolute nightmare because you almost have to advance field by field. It's very difficult to use armour or artillery or air support to make things easier. So the Americans take very heavy casualties working their way through this terrain, and there's just no way of doing it quickly or easily.
I take it Ultra feeds into the eventual breakout or the breaking of this stalemate?
Naturally.
Of course. So,
if we talk about Cobra first, so this is the American breakout. On the 25th of July, they're finally in a position where they're out of some of the worst Bocage country. They've worn the Germans down. They've kind of got their logistics and their artillery and everything else in place, and they're ready to launch a heavy attack. And they start off with an attack by heavy bombers to saturate an area of the German front and then break through and just drive south as fast as they can. And this is where the German line starts to crack. And Ultra feeds into that because it gives this general picture of the German forces facing the Americans, the sort of level of casualties they've taken, the fact that they're weakening and they're not getting any stronger. They're low on tanks and guns and everything else you need. And once they've started breaking through, there's always that sort of that period of a few days in one of these offences where they're gaining momentum. But in the first few days, there's some Ultra that comes in that indicates the Germans still have their eyes elsewhere, still have their attention mostly on the British around Caen, because they're telling their air forces to not prioritise the American sector. And it's sort of negative intelligence.
Okay.
The Germans haven't quite twigged how serious this American breakthrough might get. Their focus is still on the British zone. So in the case of Cobra, the Ultra story is relatively straightforward. But a bit before Cobra, if we backtrack by a week or so, there is a British offensive, which is sort of designed to lay the groundwork for it, which is called Operation Goodwood. And here the situation is a lot more ambiguous about how Ultra feeds into it. What Goodwood is a mass tank attack. The British have 3 armoured divisions. The idea is to employ all of them all on one day, one after the other, attacking from the opposite side of the city of Caen than Operation Epsom. It's better tank country at the extreme eastern end of the beachhead and try and dislodge the German position that way. And now Montgomery and, you know, the British official history and some of the books that come about quite soon after the war later claim that Goodwood was designed to pin down German armour to keep it away from the American sector as preparation for Cobra.
Now, you say the official histories in Montgomery after the war, but at the time, is Ultra painting that picture for them? Are they seeing that?
It kind of isn't. The problem they have at this point is that the Ultra is getting more scant during this period in the middle of the campaign in Normandy because it's stabilised. The Germans are putting less on the radio.
Yeah.
They've managed to get their landlines in place and the traffic's dropped and they're still breaking all the air traffic because they always break the air traffic. But the army keys decline quite significantly compared to the period just after the landings through to like the fall of Cherbourg. And it doesn't really pick up again until after Operation Cobra. So you've got this period where there's not as much intelligence as they'd like. And it's hard to see that the intelligence is there to really inform what the British are planning with Operation Goodwood. One thing it does show is that the Germans do anticipate a British attack around Caen, and especially from the extreme eastern end of the beachhead, which is where Goodwood is going to go in. So if you're Montgomery and you want to pin down the German armour, and they already expect you to attack, the job is done. You don't need to actually attack them and prove them right. You know their tanks are going to stay there,
yes,
ready for you. So this significantly undermines his explanation as to what the plan was for Goodwood.
XL2287, 10:36 hours, 16th of July, 1944. Orders from Spurler at 0001 hours on the 16th. Extracts for information. Fliegerdivision 2 from Luftflotte. Orders for operations against Allied concentrations in Caen to Tilly area and expected large-scale Allied attacks towards the southeast. From concentrations revealed by Recce in Caen to Tilly area, it appears probably that Allies will begin their large-scale attack southeastwards from this area about the night of the 17th to 18th. Successful defence against this attack, which is decisive for the further course of the war, is of critical importance.
You know, you have German reserves being taken out of the front line, and instead of being sent to shore up the front on the American sector, they're being sent the other way, eastward, to block the British route to Paris. If you remove hindsight from the equation, it looks like what they're going for here is just a straight breakthrough. And Miles Dempsey, again, he comes in here, and it's really his plan for Operation Goodwood. He's obviously aiming for a breakthrough. His, you know, the idea of using all your armour in one big punch seems to support that. But the problem is, and there is a certain amount of discussion between Montgomery and Dempsey, and they end up altering the plan. What Montgomery wants to do is put more emphasis on basically securing the ground they capture rather than pushing forwards. It's especially about how they deal with the terrain they're moving through. Sort of east of Caen, the terrain is good tank country, quite open. It's not bocage like the Americans are fighting through. But you have a number of villages which are effectively fortresses which the Germans have entrenched themselves in. And when you're attacking, you can either bypass these villages or you can capture them. But you can't really do both. Montgomery basically alters the plan so that these villages will be captured as they go, rather than bypassing them and moving forwards. And that's always going to dilute the force of the attack and lower the momentum.
Yeah, it's going to slow it down, yeah.
And it means the infantry with the armoured divisions isn't available to actually support the tanks at the front because they're bogged down clearing out these villages. So there's a certain amount of confusion about how the plan is going to be carried out. And the big problem, I suppose, is that there's so little Ultra that they don't know what they're going into. They know the Germans are anticipating the attack and they've prepared a defence. They don't know what that defence constitutes precisely because they're not breaking enough traffic.
So it sounds like Goodwood probably started with one objective and then kind of changed as it moved along, really, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Now, whether that's because they meet more force than they were expecting, who knows? We can't really tell, can we?
They kind of try and hedge their bets and end up
failing.
Maybe not achieving as much as they could have done. But when we look at the intelligence picture, we know that Montgomery and Dempsey, they know the Germans are waiting for them, but they didn't know exactly what they were sending their troops into. And that's kind of the worst possible intelligence picture. So a good example there, obviously, of how the fact that if a commander has a plan and they want to do something, they're not going to let the intelligence get in the way most of the time. They're going to crack on with what they want to do. So in the end, the armor attacks, they bypass these villages. The infantry get bogged down in the villages, can't support the armor. And a lot of these tanks are picked off by German anti-tank guns, and eventually their armor's committed, and that causes further casualties. So the British take pretty heavy losses, especially of tanks. They lose something like 400 tanks in this battle. Luckily, most of the crews will survive, and they have replacement tanks. And this is part of Dempsey's reasoning, is that they can afford to spend machinery. They can't afford to spend lives. And it's also worth noting that the offensive isn't a failure. They capture about 8 miles of territory, which is significant by anyone's standards, especially in a place like Normandy. And they finally capture Caen, because once they hook around it on one side, the Germans see their position is untenable and they withdraw from the parts of the city that they still occupy. And that does put the British and Canadian forces beyond all those hills and rivers, at the top of that plain leading southwards from Caen, into that good tank country where they wanted to be from the beginning of the invasion, really. So it sets them up well for further offensives, but it didn't come close to the breakthrough that Dempsey was probably hoping for.
Canadian troops join the main assault on the ancient city of Caen. Caen is an important military objective because of the strategic position it occupies. Its possession consolidates territory already held and frees the hands of the British Second Army for more open operations. Canadian troops play the leading part in one of the most massive assaults that Rommel has had to face in this war. Entering from the north, the onslaught carves its way right through Caen to the junction of the Odon and Orne rivers, due south of the town. Ruined buildings stand as evidence to the effectiveness of the naval support bombardment. The 16-inch guns of the battleship Rodney demolish entire enemy strong points. As the tide of battle moves forward, French civilians return to collect the salvage of their ruined homes. Life begins anew in battered Caen.
Now, your final selection follows on from our previous one, doesn't it?
Yes, so a few days after Operation Goodwood, if we shift our focus back to the American sector, that's where they launch their Operation Cobra, which turns into the breakout from Normandy, essentially. And what it's going to lead to is a resumption of mobile warfare and force the Germans back onto using radio traffic. Ciphers become easier to break. There's a big increase in the amount of Ultra being produced. We're going to see a period towards the end of the campaign where Ultra is being produced in a large volume again, and intelligence is going to be coming out of Bletchley Park, which is informing what the Allied commanders are doing in quite a detailed way.
What's the outcome of Cobra then?
So they push southwards, they capture the town of Avranches at the very bottom of the Cotentin Peninsula, where the coast turns west towards Brittany, and they capture the crossings over the rivers there, so they can start to exploit the breakthrough. And at this point, the American force is split in two. US First Army, which was Bradley's command, is joined by Third Army under General Patton. He's come over from Britain, where he was posing as commander of the fictitious First US Army Group. And that's activated, and Patton is sort of unleashed to plunge into the interior of France. And Bradley, meanwhile, is promoted to be head of 12th Army Group in charge of those two armies. So he shifts from being under Montgomery's command as an army commander to an independent command directly under Eisenhower as Supreme Allied Commander. So what these moves create is a sort of, again, a salient with the coast on one side, German forces on the other, and quite a narrow gap near Avranches, where all of the supplies for Third Army and a lot of First Army are having to flow through. And Hitler thinks he sees an opportunity here. And there certainly would be an opportunity if the German army in Normandy was in a fit state to launch any sort of offensive. Unfortunately, it's not, and his generals know that. But Hitler looks at the map and goes, well, if we cut through to the coast at Avranches, we'll cut off the Third Army and we can destroy it, and then we can simply roll the Allies all the way back northwards and push them back into the sea. As I say, that's a brilliant plan if you've got a big armoured reserve. And the fact that the Germans don't have any sort of armour reserve to carry out this sort of offensive doesn't really get in the way for Hitler. And he orders his generals to launch this offensive, and it becomes known as the Mortain Counteroffensive.
Despite German claims that everything is calmed down inside Germany, there are increasing signs today that the revolt of army leaders is not yet over. the new chief of the German Army General Staff, has told his troops by radio that some of the officers who led the revolt were on active service. Now for the latest military developments in France and in Europe, Admiral takes you to London, Charles Collingwood reporting.
On the front, the Germans have been putting in what one correspondent describes as a surprisingly large number of very small counterattacks against our positions in Normandy. There is certainly no indication that the troops there have been particularly shaken by the revelation of a plot to overthrow Hitler. These German soldiers in France, including a high proportion of SS divisions, are fighting very hard.
I mean, another factor in the German generals having to follow Hitler's orders are, we're talking about the period just after the failed bomb plot on July the 20th, aren't we?
Yeah, so Hitler's narrowly escaped assassination. He's busy purging anyone in the military who's shown the slightest dissent.
Thousands of officers at this point have either already been executed or are on the route to that. So it's kind of knuckle down and do what the boss says, isn't
it? It's not the time to say no to Hitler.
No.
But as we'll see from the ultra, there's a tiny bit of room for manoeuvre. By this point, the German commander in the West is von Kluge, because von Rundstedt had been removed, having basically stood up to Hitler and suffered for it. And Kluge decides to interpret Hitler's instructions as basically a spoiling attack in the first instance, because that's the only thing that makes sense to him as a general, because anything else is fantasy. So he starts putting this plan together. The Germans start pulling the remnants of their armored division out of the front line and reforming them and trying to get them over to the westernmost point where they can launch this attack towards the coast. And Ultra follows all of this. And in particular, on the 6th of August, you have two messages shortly after 7 p.m. that come through from Hut 3. And one of those is a request for air cover from 2nd SS Division. So that's standard sort of FLEVO stuff. But by this point, everybody familiar with Ultra knows that when air cover is requested, that means Germans are going to attack. And there's also a message about the reorganization of four panzer divisions under a new corps.
XL 5027, 0011 hours, 7th of August, 1944. According to Jagd Corps 2, at 1700 hours on 6th. 7th Army to attack from 1830 hours on the 6th, with strong forces of five panzer divisions from area Sœur-de-Val to Mortain, towards the west. First objective of attack, road Bressy to Montigny. Jagd Corps 2 to support attack with all forces except Jagd Geschwader 2.
By normal standards, you know, the Germans very rarely say we're going to attack in those words.
No.
But requests for air support, reorganizations like that, troops on the move, it's all the sort of warning signs that you need to anticipate what the Germans are going to do. But of course, the Allies are also constrained in their interpretation by the fact that the German moves make absolutely no military sense. So it's helpful when they get some further proof in, and the Germans send a message about 5 p.m, which comes through from Hut 3 about midnight on the 6th of August, which actually gives the time of the attack and the initial objectives. And that time was earlier in the day, but in the end it's delayed. So by the time it arrives, it's about the time the offensive actually goes ahead. So shortly after midnight on the 7th, those are at Bradley's headquarters. And so he knows what's coming. Just as an aside here, there's an interesting point here about the addresses on the messages. So you can tell where an ultra message goes because there are a number of address groups, as they call them. They're bigrams, they're pairs of letters. Each of those indicates a particular special liaison unit out in the field attached to a particular command. Now, those SLUs are all interchangeable and standardized, and they move around quite often. So keeping track of who they're actually serving at a particular point in time is quite difficult sometimes. Yeah. And the system is always quite flexible. So when the 12th Army Group is activated, which is on the 1st of August, it received the unit which had been serving 1st US Army Group,
the
taking lots of spoof traffic in England. And that gets renamed under a new address group. And it also takes the SLU that had been serving Montgomery's 21st Army Group, also in Normandy. And all these units start to shift around. What's interesting is if you look at the messages around the German counteroffensive towards Mortain, they don't show either of the address groups associated with 12th Army Group, Bradley's command, even though he must have received that intelligence. And there's lots of other good information that shows he received that intelligence. but he's not in the list of recipients. But there is a sort of mystery delivery group, which is BV, and it doesn't appear in any of the histories that I've been able to access.
Oh.
There's no explanation of what BV refers to. But what my assumption is that it's a very temporary station put together to keep Bradley in the loop while all these shifts of SMUs are happening.
While everything else is moving around. Yeah. Okay.
And this breakout is going on. The whole SLU system is overstretched. The whole command system on the Allied side is overstretched. It's all being reorganized very, very quickly. So they seem to put the scratch unit together and put them under a very temporary address group. This is where Humphrey is sending the information they want to get to Bradley.
Is there a reason why they move the SLUs around? Is it for security reasons, radio security reasons?
I don't believe it is. It's just to make the maximum use of their resources. They just don't have that many trained personnel in these units, and they have a lot of commands to cover. And as generals get used to using Ultra, they tend to start asking for more SLUs because they want, you know, the accompanying air command to have its own unit so they don't have to co-locate the headquarters. And they get all these other demands for new units, and they're really struggling to raise them as fast as people are asking for them. So it's just about making sure they've got their personnel arranged in the most efficient way. So this intelligence does come through to Bradley. But another interesting point in this instance is that Bradley tells us in his memoirs that he wasn't really dependent on Ultra at this point. What Bradley writes is that in this instance, Ultra was of little or no value. But you have to look at the historiography to understand why he says that, because he's pushing back against Frederick Winterbottom.
Why? Has Winterbottom said something different then?
Because Winterbottom in the Ultra Secret claimed that the Allies knew about the Mortain counteroffensive from the very earliest planning.
Oh, right. Okay.
And that doesn't seem to be the case. And Bradley is quite right to dispute Winterbottom on that. So it doesn't look like he gets much advance intelligence on the offensive. There might have been some sort of peripheral intelligence in that he seems to have believed that the Germans were shifting their armour around to try and buy time and shore up their line. And he did identify the corridor between Mortain and the coast at Avranches was potentially vulnerable, and he put some of his best divisions there to protect it. So he kind of takes the steps you would expect if he had anticipated this offensive, but he doesn't have solid proof that it's happening. And Winterbottom is incorrect to say that.
The reaching of Avranches signified the culmination of the breakthrough and the point at which our forces split for the westward and eastward drives in the breakout. To the west, there was the dash across Brittany, where the ports of Saint-Malo and Brest finally became prizes of conquest. To the east, there was the repulse of the German counterattack at Mortain, where the American infantrymen withstood the onslaught of four German armored divisions and turned back Hitler's attempt to halt the Allied mobile column. The Allies closed at Argentan and Falaise, where they virtually destroyed two German field armies.
Even though he says Ultra was of little or no value, Bradley does actually also report he does receive that short-term warning on the 6th of August with about 6 hours warning, and he took precautions to make sure that, you know, if an offensive did happen, he'd be ready. And actually, Patton also at this point, he noted in his diary that they'd received a rumour last night from a secret source about a possible German attack. So it went through to Patton as well. So all the American generals are in the picture before this offensive lands.
What was the outcome in the end?
It's quite a famous battle in kind of the American annals, and there's pretty hard fighting, especially around the town of Mortain, on one particular hill. Gets cut off by the German armour spearheads for a time, but that's pretty localised. In the end, most of the German forces actually don't really make their way over the start line. As soon as this armour appears and is spotted from the air by the Allies, I mean, it's under very heavy attack, and they make barely any progress anywhere along the line. They don't get anywhere close to their initial objectives. So again, whether Ultra makes a difference here, because the German attack is so feeble, whether the Ultra warning tips the balance in the Allies' favour, it's kind of hard to argue. I would suggest that actually the important impact from Ultra comes a little bit later. When Hitler realises that Kluger isn't really fully committed to this offensive, he starts to send him more urgent instructions, insisting that he pulls out more divisions out of the line and attacks more strongly. And Bletchley Park breaks one of these messages. It seems to be actually a Lorenz message, which is pretty exceptional because it's decrypted, at least partially, in only about 9 hours. So I think they knew exactly what they were going to read on this occasion. And I can read a bit of it out. And you can see Hitler's mark on this message. It's clearly one of these orders that comes down almost, you know, dictated by him personally. It says, orders to 7th Army and General der Panzertruppen Eberbach. So that's the armoured group that to carry out the offensive. 1800 on the 9th of August. Attack on southern wing of 7th Army will be conducted by Panzergruppe Eberbach after regrouping and bringing up a decisive offensive arms. On its success depends the fate of Battle of France. Objective of attack, the sea at Avranches, to which a bold and unhesitating thrust through is to be made, rear attacking waves swinging north as and when opportunity occurs. And Bradley clearly read this at the time, and he says in his memoir, now we had learned from Ultra that von Kluge's offensive at Mortain had been ordered by Hitler himself, and that it was intended to be much more than a bluff to cover a withdrawal. That's how Patton had described it. Typically disregards the threat entirely, but Bradley at this point, from this particular message, he knows there's an opportunity here now, that the Germans are throwing their best troops, actually instead of retreating from France, they're actually throwing them into the position where it will be hardest to extricate them. And then Bradley can go for what turns into a battle of encirclement and ends up with the Falaise pocket.
Which is basically the end of the German army in Normandy, isn't it?
Absolutely. So it gets basically surrounded, very badly mauled. And in the end, there's still controversy about whether the encirclement was carried out in the best way, whether the pocket could have been closed more quickly. Bradley seems to go for a short encirclement and then try and widen it out again a bit later on. And he sort of goes back and forth between these different plans. And part of that, again, is arguably because of the way he interprets some of the Ultra coming through. And he's unsure whether the bulk of the German army is still in the pocket or it's already withdrawn from the pocket. But I think a lot of that is sort of by the by. At the end of the day, it's an enormous victory for the Allies. The German forces in France are absolutely crushed. And, you know, they're running with their tails between their legs as fast as they can for the German border.
I mean, at this point, what a lot of people don't remember is that the Allies actually surpassed the speed of the German blitzkrieg in 1940, don't they?
Yeah, it's incredible how quickly they make up ground at this point. And they advance from northern France, really, to northern Belgium in a very, very short space of time. And of course, as our other podcast suggests in its title, they made it to the Seine and liberate Paris within the 90-day deadline. Actually, I think in about 78 days. So they're ahead of schedule, even though they got bogged down in Normandy for so long and had this grueling fight there. It turns out, actually, it was always a bad battle plan on the German side. It would always have been better for the Germans to fight further inland, a more mobile battle. But they commit to this attritional slog in Normandy, and it turns out very badly for them in the end. And the Allies make their objectives ahead of time.
Supreme Allied Headquarters reports that the Americans have begun a general advance on a 30-mile front in France today with terrific support from the Air Command. There was also another heavy bombing of the southern French coast, the kind that in the past has preceded landing operations. And now for news sent direct from overseas, Admiral takes you to London, Richard C. Hottolett reporting.
The Germans are trying to pull their forces out of the Allied trap in western France today. Since yesterday afternoon, German infantry, armor, motor, transport, and horse-drawn equipment have been crowding the few remaining roads that lead out through the Falaise Gap. Something like 100,000 men and several hundred tanks are trying to get out. And all this time, during every hour of daylight, these choked roads have been bombed, machine-gunned, and hit by the rockets of all the medium and fighter bombers we could put into the air. Correspondents at the front have described the bombs cascading down from planes glistening in the sun. And the Germans' only protection has been the dust of their escape. Meanwhile, the gap through which the Germans are trying to escape is being narrowed down. There are now only about 30 miles of escape gap left for the Germans, and with this American strength in the area, we can be sure that it's in the process of being narrowed down right now.
Your five examples are quite a mixed bag. Is there anything we can take away from what this teaches us about the use of Ultra?
That it's complicated and difficult, and you know, you have to approach it on a case-by-case basis, and it's very dangerous sometimes to make generalizations about how this sort of intelligence work is done and the impact it has. You know, we can make some general points. again, that fundamental point about the value of Ultra being in the big picture is absolutely true, because we've got to remember, you know, around all of these scenarios that I've talked about, all the Allied generals have excellent information about what enemy divisions they're facing, how they're equipped, supplies, manpower, fighting fitness, and all of this. And that's absolutely invaluable. They're never in the dark about the basic facts. You know, before Goodwood, they could have had better information about the German defences, but they still know basically what forces are facing them. And that big picture was always going to be more valuable if you had to pick and choose than the tactical stuff. But what we see in these examples is that the medium-term sort of Ultra, not maybe what the Germans will do tomorrow, but what they might do in a few days' time, is also very influential. So we see at Carentan, they could anticipate the arrival of the 17th SS Division. In Operation Epsom and in Mortain, Ultra gave the Allies ways to anticipate what the Germans were doing. Maybe not perfect information, maybe not as quickly as they wanted, but much better than nothing. There was a link between intelligence and action, maybe not as neat as some people like to claim, but it was very real. I'd say what the Allies are maybe less good at is using Ultra to actually guide their own offensive decision-making, because they show that natural tendency. When a commander wants to do something, they look for intelligence which supports their intentions, and they tend to disregard intelligence that doesn't fit. And I think before Goodwood, we can certainly see that the intelligence picture wasn't really supporting the rationale for the operation. And that didn't stop Montgomery and Dempsey from carrying out their plan. And it might be in the case, arguably in that case, you know, the whole planning process, just the amount of work and the amount of organization that has to go into an offensive and the number of balls you have to juggle at that stage mean that inevitably some of the people involved take their eye off intelligence and it kind of falls down the priority list. And there's always a danger, of course, you know, if you do have your eye on the intelligence, you can misinterpret it, read too much into it. And that can be dangerous as well. So all of this just undermines that mistaken assumption that a piece of intelligence leads to a particular optimum act on the part of the commander. That's just not how it works. Generalship is just much more kind of freewheeling and improvisational than historians, I think especially historians of intelligence, like to assume.
I think generally commanders in the field, they're looking for something in the intelligence that will affirm what they're planning to do is right, won't they?
There's always that tendency. I think if you look at it that way, if you look at that as a natural tendency, then you have to give the Allied generals credit for not falling into that trap more often than they did. And none of what we're saying here means the Allies are bad at intelligence, because, you know, kind of making your plans and what you can do conform with what the intelligence says you should do and what the enemy let you do, it's kind of basically an impossible problem. You just do the best you can and you have to compromise. But overall, the Allies do have a very good intelligence system. They are very good at this work, at generating intelligence and putting it to use in all its forms, not just signals intelligence. And they use it, they use it very well. Far better than the Germans do, and that's the point, and that's why they win.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.